Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Community Regional Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, February 17th, 2022. Let the record reflect the time is 3:30 p.m. Today we have President Vice Chair Myers and Senator Gray Jackson, myself, Chair Hughes. And please silence your cell phones if you haven't already. And thank you to Juliana Singh and Talia Ames for being with us and assisting. We really appreciate what you do every day. We have two items on today's agenda. First, we'll turn our attention to SB 177 microreactors transmitted by Governor Dunleavy. And we're going to have a presentation from Dr. Ashley Finan, Director of the National Reactor Innovation Center at Idaho National Lab. And Dr. Finan will be joined by her colleagues, Dr. Parisi and Dr. Sabharwal. And I may be butchering names, so that I'm sure they'll set me straight. They are also from the Idaho National Lab and will be available to chime in and assist with any questions we might have. And after we conclude that presentation, we will then hear from Senator Willikowski and his staff, Nick Moe, who are presenting SB 172 property tax exemption. And are there any members? Are there any questions from members before we get rolling? Okay, seeing none. So we're going to take a brief at ease to get the projector and everything set up. And we're back on the record. And thank you to Laura Ashe. She's going to be controlling the slides that are before us. And I want to point out before we bring on Dr. Finan that we have several people online. I know I'm going to rattle these off, so please feel free to ask again, because we've got just some wonderful resources. So she will be the main presenter, Dr. Finan, but we have a scientist who focuses on safety, and that is Dr. Carlo Parisi. And then we have another scientist, the lead on advanced heat transport and having to do with coolant. Okay, so we've got somebody for safety, somebody for the heat coolant subject. And then we again have Gwen Holdman, who presented to us the other day from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and she's more for general questions. And we have Christina Carpenter, who is the Director of Division of Environmental Health and Department of Environmental Conservation. And then in addition, we have Mark Nickel, who is the Senior Director of New Reactor Deployment Nuclear Energy Institute. And his focus, his area of expertise is economic and waste. So we kind of, and then lastly, we have Allison Natcher, who is the liaison for DNR with NRC. So, but as far as safety, heating, cooling, and economics and waste, we have experts. So I just want to, you may not remember their names, but those are areas we can address specific questions. Okay, so with this, we have on Teams, we have Dr. Finan. And so welcome today to the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee. If you could please state your name, affiliation, and location for the record and proceed with your presentation. And we have someone controlling the slides, so you can communicate when you're ready for the next slide. So begin, Dr. Finan.
Thank you, Chair. Ashley Finan, I'm the Director of the National Reactor Innovation Center at Idaho National Laboratory, and I'm calling in from Victor, Idaho. Did I sufficiently answer those questions?
Yes, you did well. Thank you. Proceed.
Okay, perfect. And I just before I begin, I want to introduce a little bit more my two colleagues who have been kind enough to join me. Dr. Piyush Sabharwal is a senior staff nuclear research scientist in the Nuclear Science and Technology Directorate at INL. He has more than 17 years' experience in advanced reactor R&D. And he's the technical lead on the U.S. Department of Energy's microreactor R&D program, as well as leading some key R&D projects at the laboratory. And Dr. Carlo Parisi is a scientist with over 18 years of experience in academia and the labs. He has a Master of Science and a PhD in nuclear engineering from the University of Pisa in Italy. And his area of expertise includes, as you stated, Chair Hughes, thermal hydraulics, and then neutronics and uncertainty qualification. And in particular, Dr. Sabharwal is an expert in gas reactors and molten salt reactors, and Dr. Parisi is an expert in advanced light water reactors and sodium fast reactors. So if we get into detailed questions, they'll be able to provide those answers. But I'll go ahead and get started on the overview. And I'll thank you, Chair Hughes, for having me today, as well as thank the distinguished members of the committee. It's really nice to have the opportunity to speak with you. I have some slides, so I will go through those, but please, I'll stop at each slide and ask for questions. Please don't hesitate to interrupt. I certainly prefer the question and answer, and look forward to answering your questions.
Before you continue, I can you repeat how you pronounce your last name? I don't want to mispronounce it through it, and I didn't listen closely when you said it.
It's Finan.
Okay, I got it right. And I am just pretty overwhelmed at this moment with the amount of intelligence and expertise of the folks you just introduced, and I do encourage members to take advantage of it, because it's not every day we have this level of knowledge available to us. So go ahead, Dr. Finan.
Thank you so much, Chair Hughes. And thank you to Laura for running the slides. You can go ahead and go to the next slide. I'm going to be speaking about advanced reactor concepts and an overview of reactor safety today. So this first slide, I know that you've been getting a lot of testimony and education recently on advanced reactors, but I wanted to have just one quick overview slide on advanced fission. As I think you know, it's characterized in terms of capacity, and micro reactors at less than 50 megawatt electric are what this committee is focused on, but there are also small reactors, medium reactors, and large reactors ranging up to the thousands of megawatts. One of the things that distinguishes the different designs is that they use a variety of different coolants, and you'll hear them referred to as gas, sodium, salt, lead, or water reactors, and that's because of the coolant that they're using typically. Advanced fission is a clean, high availability energy source, and we're seeing it reaching into diverse market opportunities, as I know you've heard testimony on that already. And some of the key goals of advanced reactors include improved safety, waste, security, and target economics for those designs. And there are many private sector companies involved in this. There are more than 60 projects underway. And in particular, there are more than a dozen that we get to work with at Idaho National Laboratory every day. So that's been very rewarding for all of us. Laura, you can go to the next slide, please.
Dr. Finan, can you just tell us just for a moment about the Idaho National Laboratory itself? Is that a federally funded laboratory, or is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I can speak to that. So Idaho National Laboratory is located in and around Idaho Falls, Idaho. It is about a $1.6 billion a year organization. It is a Department of Energy laboratory, and it's the nation's lead nuclear energy laboratory. But INL also does quite a bit of work in other areas, very strong work in cybersecurity for national homeland security topics and the Department of Defense, as well as work in integrated energy systems and renewable energy sources, and probably more than I can name all right now, but there's a lot of work that goes on. It's also that really has a legacy of nuclear demonstration, because the nation's National Reactor Testing Station was located in the same place at Idaho National Laboratory back in 1949, and the nation demonstrated about 52 reactors on that site, where we're now working to demonstrate more reactors of this advanced variety. And there are about 5,000 employees, I believe I have that right, at Idaho National Laboratory, many of them quite like Dr. Sabharwal and Dr. Parisi and myself, who are really focused on nuclear, but also cybersecurity and other energy sources.
So you are all federal employees then, is that correct?
We are contractors, so not federal employees, but we're employees of Battelle Energy Alliance, which is the government, which is the contractor that operates the laboratory on behalf of the Department of Energy.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful background information.
Yeah, absolutely. I can provide more background on Idaho National Laboratory in the future as well. Okay, so are there any other questions at this point?
I'm not seeing any. Go ahead.
Okay. Then I think you're on the next slide.
Well, actually, I don't think if you go back a slide where it talks about the megawatts for the various sized cities, I don't think you touched on that. Could you just
I didn't. That's true. I can speak to that. So that's just an estimate of about how much energy a small town or a city uses. So this is electricity use. A small town, generally will use about a megawatt of electricity. A mid-sized city might use a gigawatt, and the United States has about 1,000 gigawatts or a terawatt of electricity use.
So for a small town, what would the average, what population? We have very tiny towns, so we have
right.
So what are your population amounts for
A small town here is probably much larger than your typical Alaskan town. It's probably more on the order of at least tens of thousands, if not 100,000. I can check on that and get you a firm answer.
Okay, that's helpful though. Thank you.
Okay, to the next slide then. Thank you. So a little bit more on advanced reactor design types. Some of the key design types that we are working on in the United States right now are listed here on the right, and I'm just going to walk through those. They're high temperature gas reactors, which typically use a helium coolant and a TRISO fuel form, which I think TRISO has come up in previous hearings, but I'll speak to that more later. It's an important part of the safety approach for high temperature gas reactors and for some other reactors. And you'll see TRISO fuel used in many micro reactor designs. So it's a particular import here, I think. Sodium fast reactors use a liquid sodium metal coolant. Lead fast reactors use a liquid lead or a molten lead coolant. Salt cooled reactors use a solid fuel with a molten salt coolant. So that solid fuel in the designs that are in development now is also the TRISO fuel that I mentioned earlier. And then molten salt fueled reactors are perhaps the most different from the others in that they use a liquid fuel. So there's a molten salt coolant in which the fuel is dissolved. So that's a significantly different design. And then water cooled reactors, which most of the reactors that we have around the United States now are water cooled. But there are some advanced designs that seek to improve upon the existing fleet. And there are other variations that I haven't mentioned here. But these, the ones that I've listed, really represent all of the demonstrations that are moving forward today in the U.S. And I'll note that all of these coolants have been demonstrated in some form in reactors around the world over past decades. So none of this is entirely new. It's more innovation that takes some proven technology and puts a new spin on it. To reach new markets and new operating profiles. So are there any questions on this?
Continue.
Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so this should be a diagram of a pressurized water reactor. The pressurized water reactor represents many of the reactors around the United States now. There are two different water reactor types. This is one of the main types that we have. And I just want to describe how this reactor works because it's actually not that different from the other advanced reactors, and you'll see that shortly. So here on the bottom left area, there's a red box, and that little red box is the reactor core. In that core, you have the fuel that is fissioning. And the fission process, fission is what occurs when a neutron hits an atom, a uranium atom. It splits that uranium atom into two other products and energy and some more neutrons. And that reaction causes more of these reactions, and you're releasing energy in the core. And that energy is heating up water in this case, in that reactor. And it's the purple water in the diagram if your colors are like mine. And that water gets heated up. And then that heat gets transferred to a balance of plant where you produce an energy product. So here you see the purple water goes to a steam generator, that a secondary loop cool water is coming in blue, and then you're making steam there using the heat from the reactor. That steam goes up through the steam line and drives a turbine generator that makes electricity in this case. And you have a cooling function on the right that cools that water before it goes back to the steam generator, and it continues to get heated by the reactor. Most nuclear reactors work like this. You have a core that's making heat, and that's driving a turbine generator that makes electricity in this case. A key goal of nuclear safety is to keep the radioactivity in the fuel. So in that red box where you have the core and the fuel, when those fission reactions are taking place, you're creating energy and you're creating a couple of new atoms, daughter products of the fission. And those fission products are radioactive, many of them are. So that's where your radioactivity is getting made. And if everything's working well, that stays inside the fuel, which stays inside the core. If fuel gets damaged, then those radioactive products can come out of the fuel and get into that purple water in this diagram. And if that happens, then we've lost our first level of protection. We've broken the fuel. And this is very rare, but on a bad day, if that happens, now it's in the water. And now what we want to do is make sure that it stays there, that it stays in the reactor and doesn't get outside into the environment. So if it stays in the reactor, that's good. If it gets out into the containment structure, now it's in the containment, it's still contained, and we have a mess, but we still contained it and we have safety that's maintained. If that containment structure fails, now you're going to be filtering any products that are leaving the containment. And if we fail at that, then we're evacuating. This is how you might have, this is what happened, for example, at Fukushima. And everything really at the end of the day went wrong and we have evacuation. So that's what that looks like in this case. And the goal here is to avoid that. If you go to the next slide, I want to show two diagrams of some examples of advanced, oh, maybe I should ask Chair Hughes if there are any questions before I go on.
I'm not seeing any. Keep going, please. Thank
you. Okay, thanks. So on the next slide, there are two examples of advanced reactors. The one on the left, these are from the Generation 4 International Forum, which is an international effort which the U.S. is a part of to develop and deploy advanced reactors ultimately. So one example here is on the left. It's a high-temperature gas reactor. It's called a very high temperature reactor in that forum, but we typically refer to it here as a high temperature gas reactor. On the right is a sodium cooled fast reactor. And I won't go into detail on these, but what I want to highlight is that it's very similar. We have a core with fuel that's fissioning and creating heat, and that heat is being transferred on the right hand side. It's being transferred to a liquid sodium, and that liquid sodium is being used to heat to make steam in the balance of plant, which is driving a turbine generator to make electric power. On the example on the left-hand side, the fission and the heat being created there is being used to heat a cycle that produces hydrogen. But again, we're basically taking reactor heat and we're moving it to the balance of plant and we're making an energy product. Again, our goal is to avoid damaging the fuel. If we do damage the fuel, it's to contain any radioactivity within the reactor. So I'm going to come back to the safety basics of how that works and how we approach that. But first, we can go to the next slide, which is a little bit about U.S. nuclear safety oversight. So safety in the U.S. is overseen by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And I'm going to go ahead and read their mission that's on the slide here. The NRC licenses and regulates the nation's civilian use of radioactive materials to provide reasonable assurance of adequate protection of public health and safety and to promote the common defense and security and to protect the environment. So the U.S. NRC is responsible for overseeing nuclear safety. They have some principles of good regulation. They have, I mean, we could talk about the NRC for days, but I wanted to highlight just a couple things here. And within their principles of good regulation, the first is independence, and that's something that the NRC takes very seriously, is their regulatory independence. So I wanted to highlight that here. You also see openness, efficiency, clarity, and reliability. The NRC is very focused on public engagement and making information available to the public, and I think that they do a very, very good job at that compared with other regulators. They really put a lot of information out to the public and have a lot of public meetings that provide real opportunities to engage. And then I also want to highlight the philosophy of defense in depth, which is a key part of how the NRC oversees safety and how we approach designing and operating nuclear facilities. So this is an approach where you have multiple independent, diverse, and redundant layers of defense. And the purpose of that is really to compensate for the possibility that something might fail or something might go wrong. So you don't want any single layer or any single system to be relied upon exclusively. Instead, you want to make sure that you have this diverse set of approaches that achieve your safety goals. On the right-hand side is a little bit more detail on how the Nuclear Regulatory Commission performs its oversight function. So I'll follow the numbers here. Number one at the top is that the NRC develops regulation and guidance for nuclear safety. Number two is that they're responsible for licensing and certifying plants and designs, as well as overseeing decommissioning processes. Number three is that they have oversight functions over operating plants. So at every nuclear plant in the United States, there is at least one resident inspector with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission who is there every day overseeing the safe operation of the plant and ensuring that they're following the proper procedures and guidance. And then in the area of operational experience, the NRC has the benefit really of overseeing all of the reactors in the U.S. And so if they see opportunities to improve, they want to share that with other reactors. So there are generic issues, for example, if they see something that comes up at one plant and that could be applicable to other plants, then they're going to share that and they're going to make sure that we learn from one plant and we apply that to the others before we need to learn again. We want to go ahead and use that right away. And then finally at the center, you see that they have some support functions. So there is a research arm of the NRC, as well as some key advisory committees and risk assessment functions. So this is a big picture of what the NRC does. It's not limited to licensing. It's actually throughout the life cycle of nuclear power plants. And if there aren't any questions, then we can go to the next slide. So I mentioned this earlier, but I'm going to focus on the goal of preventing offsite release of radioactive materials. There are other goals that we could look at, but that's a pretty big one, so I'm focused there today. I'm happy to talk about other ones if you have questions. When we think about risk of nuclear energy incidents, we think of the likelihood of an event, so the likelihood of something going wrong, and the consequences or severity of the impacts of that event. And nuclear safety efforts seek to reduce both of those elements of risk. We both want to reduce the likelihood of something going wrong, and we want to reduce the potential consequences if that should go wrong. A primary concern that it makes sense to focus on is damage to the fuel and subsequent release of radioactivity, which I described when we were on that initial diagram. So we're working to prevent damage to the fuel, and if fuel damage occurs, we're working to prevent release of radioactivity. And we're going to do all of those things because we take a defense-in-depth approach. We're not going to assume that everything goes right on one level. We're going to make sure that we have protections at multiple levels so that we have defense in depth, so that if we were wrong about something, there's another system to back us up. There are several possible causes of problematic fuel damage. Most of them relate to overheating of fuel. You'll hear about a meltdown. That's fuel that's overheated and melted. That's kind of the most common way that we see a potential accident, you know, going forward. There is some minor fuel damage that occurs regularly during operation, but it doesn't cause outside impacts. So we'll focus on these serious issues that relate to overheating. As I mentioned, there are other goals that we can look at. There are other concerns and causes for damage, but I'm focusing on these because I think that they're kind of the highest importance and probably the most interest.
Dr. Finan, Senator Myers has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with relation to the overheating, I understand that that's your primary concern. Is that because the heat then causes the reactions to speed up and possibly get out of control? Is that the issue?
It's actually, I'll talk about that a little bit on the next slide. It's more not in fact that, but that the heat can cause the fuel to, I'll go back to what I described a little while ago in not enough detail, perhaps. The fuel is actually in pellets and it's surrounded by cladding, which is a metal that holds in any of the radioactive materials that are produced during fission. If that cladding fails, so if it melts or cracks, then those radioactive materials that were held in now get released into that water that was purple in the first diagram. And now that's available to move, you know, in places that it doesn't belong. So the overheating is really about damaging the integrity of the fuel and therefore releasing radioactive materials out of the fuel into other parts of the system.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can continue.
Okay, we can go to the next slide then, please.
We've got it up.
Okay, great. So I'm going to talk a bit about how we prevent fuel damage. And one of them is controlling reactor power. So the question that was just asked was whether we're trying to avoid the reaction getting out of control. Yes, certainly that is a major principle of reactor safety. When you hear about advanced reactors, you hear a lot about passive safety and inherent safety approaches. This is one area where actually that has been the approach since the beginning. So when we look at traditional approaches to controlling reactor power, a key element of that is designing the reactor core such that the physics cause the reactor to shut down when things are going wrong, so that you don't see those uncontrolled chain reactions. So we call that a negative reactivity feedback. But one example, and this is going to sound maybe hard to understand, but I'll explain it, is a negative reactivity feedback, negative reactivity coefficient of, sorry, my kids are banging stuff in the kitchen. It got me distracted. But a negative temperature coefficient of reactivity. So sounds weird, but what it really means is that as the reactor gets hotter, your reactivity goes down and your fission starts to shut down. So we want to design a reactor. All the reactors we have in the U.S. today are designed such that as the reactor starts to heat up, things are getting maybe too hot, then the fission starts to shut down. And that's just physics in the design. So that's inherent safety. And we have negative reactivity feedback such that shutdown happens pretty automatically. But in addition, we also have mechanical shutdown approaches, which include control rods. So those are control rods that have neutron absorbers that absorb neutrons, take them out of the equation, and they stop shutdown fission because you need neutrons to have fission. So those control rods get inserted into the core, either from the top or the bottom. And then boron injection is another traditional approach. So boron is a material that absorbs neutrons, again, shutting down fission, preventing runaway chain reactions. And that can be injected into the cooling water if you want to shut down the reactor. So that's actually something that's been inherent and as well as active in traditional reactors. In terms of advanced reactor innovations and enhancements in that space, it was already a very, very firm requirement that these systems were a first line and that they work. But now we see some approaches that improve this. They include online refueling and reactors that enable you to have less excess reactivity in the core, which means that there's less potential to have a runaway chain reaction. But this is an area where the traditional approach already works very well. We haven't seen any runaway chain reactions in commercial power in the U.S., so it works very well. The next, so shutting down the reaction, that's pretty straightforward at this point. All reactors do it, but that doesn't actually eliminate heat production. There's decay heat, so you can shut down your fission and shut down your reactor, but the fuel that's in the reactor continues to produce some heat, and that's called decay heat. You have radioactive materials in there, and they produce energy as they decay. So after, as soon as you've shut down the reactor, you have about 6.5% of the full power heat is still being produced as decay heat. An hour later, you have about 1.5% of full power heat. And then it continues to decay and go down. After a day, you have 0.4% of full power heat approximately. And it doesn't sound like very much, but nuclear reactors produce a lot of energy. So that heat needs to be removed, or the fuel will continue to get hotter until it gets damaged, and then you could have it release fission products into the water in the core. Additionally, if you continue to have this heating, and if you have water in the core, water has can boil off, and so you need to be able to replace that water. So how do we traditionally maintain cooling? We have a lot of active systems. We have a lot of extra water on hand and a lot of pumps that can force that extra water into the reactor core. You have high pressure and low pressure systems to force the water into the core to bring that spare water essentially into the reactor. And then you also have a containment system where if you have water in the containment, you can circulate it and spray it down over the reactor. So there are a lot of very active systems. They require power to operate the pumps. So you have backup diesel generators to operate those pumps in the case that you lose electric power. That's a very traditional approach that involves a lot of belts and suspenders. And it works, but there are more elegant solutions that we're seeing in advanced reactor innovations and enhancements in this area. So we, in terms of enhancements, we see gravity-driven backup cooling instead of needing pumps that require electricity or generators to produce that pumping power. You might have extra water that's stored at a height so that it can just flow down into the reactor. Gravity on land always works. So we can rely on it. So that's one of the approaches. That's a passive approach to make sure that water can be brought to the reactor, even if you don't have pumping power. We have a lot more battery backups for key controls and valves. We have valve setups where valves fail safe, which means that if the power goes out, the valve's going to make sure it turns to the right direction so that you maintain cooling. It favors maintaining cooling. There are a lot of approaches that include passive natural circulation. That could be circulation of water in some of the water designs that allows us to remove coolant and doesn't require pumps, or it could be circulation of air around different vessels where you have some particular channels that are built to drive airflow and remove heat if you don't have power and you don't have pumping and coolant flow. We also see coolants with a much higher heat capacity. So sodium, lead, salt, they all can take a lot more heat before they boil. So if they don't boil off and they operate at lower pressure, then, you know, water has a tendency and steam has a tendency to try to escape. Lead and sodium, they just want to sit there. They're very heavy and they can take a lot of heat. They don't boil at the temperatures that we see in these accident scenarios. And then we have low pressure operation. So when we're using water, in order to try to keep it as water instead of steam or to try to use it efficiently, we're using it at a very high pressure. And things at high pressure, if you have a break, those are gonna try to escape. A lot of advanced reactors operate at very low pressure so that there isn't this tendency for the coolant to escape when there's a break in a system. So the goal here is to achieve either increased coping time or indefinite coping time without electric power. A lot of the major issues we've seen, so for example, Fukushima, major issue there was that they lost power. The diesel generators failed, they flooded, and so they couldn't operate pumps. And one of the things that advanced reactors do are function without electric power, either indefinitely or for a certain number of hours that gives you time to get electric power reestablished. And that's a key part of their safety case. They also are working to simplify design. Simplification can improve outcomes because there are fewer things that can be missed or can go wrong. And there's a typo here, it's reduce operator actions. So they're working to make more things automatic, inherent, and passive, because while people are, no matter how hard they train, sometimes humans make mistakes or they're not available or something can go wrong there. So reducing the number of operator actions needed to maintain safety is another approach in advanced reactors and in the innovations that we're seeing and even in conventional reactors.
Senator Myers has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when you're talking about keeping extra water available for cooling in case of a problem, I'm assuming that we're not talking about just pulling water out of the river. We have to keep some sort of distilled water or something like that available?
It could be out of the river. It varies by site and by design. It's often there are tanks present as well. So, for example, with the gravity-driven example, there are tanks of water that are at a height to provide that gravity-driven cooling.
Thank you.
Sure. We can go to the next slide then. Okay, so this is my last heavy content slide. This is about confining radioactive material. So let's say that we weren't successful in preventing fuel damage, and now we have some fuel damage. Well, how are we going to keep those radioactive materials inside the plant to avoid offsite impacts? One approach is to have physical containment or confinement approaches. And the traditional approach that you see here is a large concrete and steel containment structure that can withstand both internal pressures from steam release or other impacts and external pressures or impacts. We also have to manage hydrogen buildup, so there are active systems to manage any hydrogen buildup. This is a kind of a nuance, but if you have a water reactor that loses coolant and things start to go in a bad direction, there are some reactions that can take place that cause free hydrogen to be released into the containment, and so there are systems to eliminate that hydrogen so that it doesn't detonate or cause a fire. And those are there and they work well, but they are active, they're not passive. So the innovations and enhancements that we see in this area in advanced reactors are really interesting. One is low pressure operation. So using those coolants that can be used at very low pressure or atmospheric pressure prevents having a driving force to lose that coolant or to disperse materials. Again, steam tends to seek more space. Sodium and lead, they don't do that. So that's one approach. Another is to manage chemical interactions and minimize the hydrogen buildup that I referred to. So for example, in water reactors, there's the development of accident-tolerant fuels that don't have the same tendency to produce hydrogen under accident conditions. So that's a way to not need those active systems, is to avoid the hydrogen buildup. And another really important one is advanced fuel, such as TRISO fuel. And I have a slide on that, so I will speak to that more on the next slide, but not quite yet. But TRISO fuel is an innovative fuel design that retains the radioactive materials, and it's quite different. So I'll show you that on the next slide. But first, the other approach to confining radioactive materials or avoiding their release that's used in advanced reactors is to reduce the inventory that's available for release. So if you have less material, then less can get out. One of the ways to do that is to have higher efficiency operation. Most advanced reactors operate at much higher efficiency, so you need less fuel to make the same amount of energy. Another is to use much smaller units, like microreactors, for example, that have much lower potential to release because they have lower inventory of radioactive materials. And another is to use online refueling or removal of those fission products during operation so that you keep those levels as low as you can. Rather than refueling every 18 months or 24 months, you're consistently removing materials so that they're not available in this inventory to be released should something go very wrong.
Senator Myers has another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for the refueling aspect, the presentation that we had a couple of days ago, and maybe I'm remembering this incorrectly, but it sounded like the microreactors we were talking about were pretty small, contained within 3-4 container units. And so in my mind, that meant that if you wanted to refuel, that your reaction your reaction chamber was within a container, and so once that ran out, then you towed that away and you pulled in another container. Is that roughly what we're talking about here?
For very small reactors, that is a common model that can make a lot of sense. What I'm talking about here is more common in at least 50 megawatt electric reactors. And typically 50 to 100 or more megawatts electric, where you're actually refueling while it operates. So in those microreactor instances, the reactor operates for years, and then you're swapping it out or you're sending it back to be refueled at a centralized location. The online refueling is more of the, there are pebble designs where pebbles drop through the core and are removed at the bottom. And now you could put in fresh pebbles or you can recycle that pebble as appropriate, but you're able to remove basically spent fuel as you go. Similarly, with molten salt reactors, there are some mechanisms to remove some of the fission products that are radioactive during operation. And so that's a consistent process that's happening as you operate. So it's a little different than what you described, and it's not likely to be applied in a remote location or in a very small reactor, but instead in the more medium size.
Thank you.
Sure. All right, we can go to the next slide, which just shows you what this TRISO fuel is. It's tristructural isotropic coated particle fuel. And essentially, it retains those fission products in the fuel rather than having them contained in this cladding that can crack and leak if it fails, which typically it doesn't, but that's the failure mechanism, is that cladding leaks, radioactive products get into the water. Here you have a type of fuel that maintains structural integrity and retains those fission products even at extremely high temperatures, as high as 1600 degrees C in accident conditions. We've seen demonstrated experiments where this fuel retains those fission products. So that's really at the heart of the safety basis for high temperature gas reactors or for other reactors that use TRISO fuel. It's a very important innovation. It's used in many microreactor designs, and it's something that has been developed and qualified over the past couple of decades in the U.S., though there is experience dating back many decades in Germany and some work in South Africa, so as well as China right now, where they have an operating reactor using a similar type of fuel. Are there any questions on this?
No, you can continue, please.
Okay. Then my last slide here is just a summary. So to summarize what I've covered here, civilian nuclear power in the U.S. is regulated by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Most of the safety measures that I focused on here and most of the safety measures in nuclear plants focus on preventing damage to the fuel or release of radioactive materials if that damage should occur. Advanced reactors include safety enhancements and innovations that rely more on inherent and passive features and less on active engineered systems. And both traditional and advanced systems implement a defense-in-depth philosophy that looks to maintain safety even if certain systems don't work as planned. And that concludes my slides. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Just as a reminder that defense-in-depth philosophy involves independent, diverse, and redundant layers for safety purposes. So thank you. So I have a question. So we, of course, we are considering legislation here in Alaska, and there are different vendors out there developing various designs. And just wondering, as the different designs come forward, is there any tool or metric for evaluating them, measuring them as far as safety and you know, in protecting the environment, and et cetera? And is there a particular design that you as scientists are beginning to pick up that you think might be the best? Just what kind of things might the Alaska communities consider as they're looking at the various designs that are currently being developed?
That's a great question, and I'll invite the other experts on the line to think about what their responses might be. But I'll start by saying that the gold standard here is the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and their oversight and approval of designs or plants. And so any reactor that can be deployed is going to meet the safety regulations and requirements of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So I would look to them as the authority there and the best way to have an independent assessment of safety. All of these advanced designs have very strong but slightly different approaches to how they achieve safety outcomes, but they are all essentially working to achieve the same safety outcomes that are governed by the NRC. So I'm sorry I don't have a better...
Let me ask you this, and perhaps we can get information directly from NRC, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, just for those listening, sometimes we use acronyms and people get confused. Do they have some kind of scoring system, or is it just, yes, we approve this, no, we don't approve that, or is there any kind of metric that they use?
They do a lot of very deep analysis, and so if you wanted to go into the specifics of the analysis and which types of, you know, how what type of accident is possible at what frequency and how the reactor protects against that, that information will be available as innovators move through the regulatory process. So you're looking at accidents that are, you know, 10 to the minus 7 likelihood. And going through the regulatory documents, you should be able to see whether this accident is 10 to the minus 7 on this reactor or 10 to the minus 6 on another or 10 to the minus 8. So it is possible to try to look through that. If there are particular priorities that Alaska develops, I think that there are opportunities to make sure those get sufficiently analyzed. So if a design is approved by the NRC, but needs to be looked at in the context of deployment in Alaska, then the NRC is going to look at the particular site and the particular environmental sensitivities of that site and analyze the impacts of that reactor there. So I think that you have the opportunity to interact at that point and make sure that everything that's special about that site or special about Alaska is captured, if that makes any sense.
Makes a lot of sense. That's excellent. So I at this time, I would like to, just because of that last question and what we as Alaskans should be looking for, I'd like to bring on Dr. Carlo Parisi. Stay with us, Dr. Finan. We really appreciate your good presentation. Dr. Parisi, could you speak to that last question and as far as what we should be keying into? Your specialty is analyzing safety, from my notes, so you seem like a good one to answer this question.
Thank you.
Oh, and please state your name, affiliation, and your location for the record, please.
Sure. My name is Carlo Parisi. I'm a scientist at Idaho National Lab, and I'm speaking from Idaho Falls, Idaho.
Proceed.
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity to talk, and I completely agree with what Dr. Ashley Finan just talked about. There are several metrics that can be used for evaluating the safety of a different technology. She briefly mentioned about the probability of accident, the core damage frequency. That's something that it's a parameter that we generally look when we try to evaluate the safety of a nuclear reactor. And what I want to highlight here is that since we have such a very good and very strict safety standard in the U.S., more or less all these new design, they have achieved a probability of core damage that is very, very low. So we're talking about a probability of 10 to minus 7, as Dr. Finan was remembering. So it's a very low probability that... sometimes people also question if it also makes sense, because we are talking about events every 10 millions of years. And concerning all the different design, what we could say, there are technologies that are more mature because they have been used for a lot of time. Like, for example, light water reactor, we have plenty of experience because it's the kind of a standard design. And we have 10,000 of years of experience of reactor here of experience. Sodium fast reactor are also quite mature technologies. Other reactor, they also we know a lot, but they have been less used during the past. But that doesn't mean that they are not safer. So because every reactor has to obey to and has to respect to this safety standard and this very important safety philosophy that is the defense in depth that is adopted here in the United States. And I want to also highlight the another thing. These standards are so good that also other important nations of the world, they follow and they imitate the safety standard that we have here in the United States. So I don't know if you have any other specific questions, but I just want...
I want to follow up on that, Dr. Parisi. Mm-hmm. So I don't think any of us at this committee table are scientists or mathematicians. So when you say something has a 10 to the negative 7 probability, what does that mean? We're used to like 1 in a million. What does 10 to the negative 7th mean?
Yeah, that means that we can have the probability of having that event 1 divided 10 with 6 digits. Then, so 1 over, we can have an event every 10 million of years, or if 10 to minus 8, 100 million of years. So it's a number that also is really also difficult to grasp, you know, the probability of something very, very, very small. But this is just for a metric that can tell us how safe are these reactors. So we are two order of magnitude safer than the first reactor that they were developed during the 60 or during the 70s, where the magnitude of having an accident is 10 to minus 5. Here we have 10 to minus 7.
That's so very, very helpful. And I have two other quick questions, if you can be real concise, because I want to give other members, in case they have a question, we also want to hear from Dr. Piyush Sabharwal. How would you, I believe you maybe are from Italy, and I'm maybe hearing that in your voice. You and by the spelling of your name and your name, I'm guessing you were the PhD with that background. How would you compare our NRC and expectations and standards compared to other parts of the world?
It's the highest. I can tell you that in Italy, for example, the safety standard for nuclear power plant, they were basically mimicking, or they were almost a copy of what the NRC was developing. And that's true also for other nations of the Western world. So, yeah, I would say it's the gold standard.
Okay, thank you. And then just hearing you and hearing Dr. Finan as well, if we had communities in Alaska that were interested in pursuing this, is the Idaho National Laboratory available to assist communities that are looking and, for questions and research and maybe comparing different designs? Is that something the Idaho National Laboratory would be available to us as Alaskans?
Yeah, that's our job, and we have different expertise, including people that they do their research on new safety methods. We have a division in our directorate at INL that is just focusing their effort on improving the safety methods. We have plenty of scientists and professional people that they can answer all the questions that people from Alaska can have.
That's excellent. Dr. Parisi, do either of the other members have a question? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we spent a fair amount of time in this presentation talking about heat. In Alaska, we worry about the opposite problem, cold. And I'm just curious if some of these advanced reactor designs that we've been talking about have been extensively cold tested or not.
Dr. Parisi?
Yeah, the reactor has been built also in the Arctic Circle, so light water reactor, they operate, in the Far East, in Russia, they operate one of these reactors in Siberia. So all this technology, when is being deployed, the designer has to study and have a clear understanding of which are the meteorological condition of the site where the reactor has to be installed. Therefore, that boundary condition, they have to be reflected into the design. And yeah, the answer to your question is yes. There has been no problem so far in deploying a nuclear reactor in a place where we can have extreme low temperature.
Thank you, Dr. Parisi. I would like at this time for Dr. Piyu Subharwal, or however you pronounce your name. I'm sorry, doctor. You are, if you could speak to your area of expertise in regard to what Alaskans might be looking for, if they're looking for a particular design, and how to evaluate what might be the safest and most environmentally friendly, what would your comments be? And please state your name, affiliation, location, and then proceed.
Okay. Hi, myself, Piyush Sabharwal. I'm a research staff scientist at INL. I'm currently speaking from Idaho Falls, Idaho. So, firstly, I'm glad to be here and participate, and, you know, excellent questions. So, you know, in my current role as a microreactor technical lead, I've been, you know, carrying out experiments with my group to understand the thing which have low TRL level, which is like low technology readiness level. So the things that have low TRL levels, we do experiments, make sure that they are well understood and characterized, and we work very closely with NRC to inform them with any findings that we get. Now, the question you asked about Alaska. So if you know, I mean, Alaska has the biggest pipeline which uses thermosiphon, which is, you know, the biggest they got in US, the whole setup, if you look at the whole setup. And it does work in the frozen ground. And thermosiphon is like a heat pipe, which basically uses gravity, you know, alkali metal heat pipe, which basically use gravity to make sure the passive thermal device works to get rid of the heat. So why am I saying that? Because we are looking at heat pipes or thermosiphon for microreactors, especially the heat pipe microreactors, to take the heat away from the core to the power conversion unit, which will be producing power. So for Alaskan communities and other communities, as my fellow Dr. Parisi mentioned, we look at various conditions. It's not just one particular condition. We make sure that, you know, based on the site, based on the purpose, based on the application, the microreactor basically can handle those situations, and, you know, and we generate data to enhance our understanding before, you know, that, because that's going to be very important before anybody even applies for license to NRC. So.
Thank you very much. We are up against the clock at this point. I have one other question, and I'd like you, I may refer back to you, Dr. Finan, but we learned Gwen Holdman with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power did our introduction the other day and let us know that there was a nuclear reactor in Russia that was not the safest technology. And one of the things we wanted to know is how far it is from Alaska, from our shoreline. And so, Gwen Holdman, are you online so we can, yes, I'm seeing you are. So if you could answer what you found out, I understand you have an answer for us.
Yeah, I was,
state your name and affiliation and location, please.
Absolutely, yeah. This is Gwen Holdman. I am with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I am located in Fairbanks, Alaska right now. So, Senator Hughes, thanks for asking that question, and I'd be very interested in having Ashley or others weigh in on this. But the question came up in the hearing on Tuesday about the reactor that's docked in Pavlik Harbor in the Russian Far East. This is kind of considered to be this barge-mounted floating reactor. And so there were some questions about that. You know, the distance between Pavlik and Point Hope is about 575 miles. That was a question that we were asked on Tuesday. And, you know, that barge has been moved around a little bit. It's I think the name of it is the Academic Lomos Nosov. So I don't know if anyone else has any perceptions about that, but there is, you know, reactors that have been installed in the Arctic in several countries, but Russia has really been pursuing this strategy of having mobile reactor designs that I described as being pretty different in terms of design and deployment from what we're looking at under the U.S. NRC process.
And so I'll go to you, Dr. Finan. Should we be concerned? It doesn't sound like it's the technology that you've been describing that is considered to be quite safe. Do you have any comments? Should we be concerned about that?
It's a light water reactor design, which is the similar to many of the reactors that we have around the country today. So it doesn't include all of the enhancements that we see in these advanced reactor designs. However, it does, as Dr. Parisi mentioned, I mean, it reflects many thousands of reactor years of experience. And one of the things to note about water-cooled reactors is that they were originally developed for submarines. And the heat sink there, the water, is abundant, right, in a submarine or on a ship. So it's very difficult to run out of water for cooling in a submarine or on a ship like that. So I think that should give one some comfort. But I guess if you could take another minute, I will ask Dr. Parisi if he wants to add anything.
Go ahead, Dr. Parisi. And I'm sorry, you'll need to state your name and location affiliation again, please.
Sure. I'm Carlo Parisi, a scientist at Idaho National Lab, and I'm speaking from Idaho Falls, Idaho. I just want to, just as Dr. Finan said, the reactor that are installed on the barge that is moored in Pevek, they are reactors that are derived from the naval propulsion. So specifically, those reactors, they are used on the icebreaker, the Russian icebreaker. I don't know the detail of that plant. So I do not know if they installed more passive system, for example. But the reactor could be basically have the same level of safety that other light water reactors that are around the world have. So it's in this case, they are smaller. Those reactors, we are talking about something like a tens of megawatts. But the technology is more or less the same that is used also in Western countries. So.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And again, we are now at time. So I just want to thank all of you for being being here and available to us and educating us on a complicated topic. I think those that also were online just standing by appreciate your taking your time to be available to us. And so at this point, I'm not seeing any questions from my fellow members. So I'm going to set Senate Bill 170 aside. And at this time, we will move to our next item on the agenda, and that is Senate Bill 172, Property Tax Exemption, sponsored by Senator Willikowski. And I know he had more than one bill up, and so Nick Moe, his trusty staff, if you could come to the table, introduce the bill, and begin the presentation. And if Senator Willikowski joins us, we'll have him come up. So is that good with you, Nick? Okay. So we're going to close down the here we go. So, Nick, I think you know the drill, so you may go ahead and get started, please.
Nick Moe, staffer, Senator Willikowski. And just to reiterate, Senator Willikowski sends his apologies. I think he'll be in soon to join us. And just to tell you a little bit about Senate Bill 172. We're excited about it. I think it's a great way to offer property tax relief in a way that provides an option for municipalities and boroughs. And it kind of came about from us hearing a lot from constituents when they received, the green cards in the mail about their assessments going up, and a lot of that was some sticker shock. And so we thought, it'd be good to be preemptive and proactive and try to do something to address property taxes. And this is what Senate Bill 172 does. It increases the residential property tax exemption from $50,000 to $75,000. And, you know, this could save the average homeowner up to $400 a year.
You want to advance the slides?
Oh, yeah. just introducing the bill a little bit. Yep, thank you. Yeah, so a little bit about the bill. Increases residential property tax exemption. We really like to emphasize this is an optional tool for municipalities and boroughs. And so they can use it if they think it's a good tool for them. And it increases, as mentioned, around $400 annual savings, which is pretty substantial. If you look at a life of a mortgage, you know, that's between $12,000 and $14,000. You know, we've seen property taxes all over Alaska increase pretty dramatically in the last few years. You know, the cost of living in Alaska has increased as well, while the average income hasn't even doubled in the last 20 years. Just a little bit about the property tax burden. Anchorage saw the second largest property tax growth in the country between 2019 and 2020. You know, I mentioned the property assessment cards. Up and down the rail belt, there's very dramatic increases this year. And many Alaskans are looking for different solutions on to the increase in property taxes. And just a little history, 10 years ago, there was an initiative that that passed that increased the residential property tax exemption from $20,000 to $50,000. So currently, six different boroughs and municipalities now take full advantage of this exemption. And the population of these boroughs represents a majority of Alaskans.
Nick, do you happen to know six are taking advantage? How many boroughs and municipalities do we have that have property taxes that aren't taking advantage? I'm just curious if you know.
There's about 18, I think, boroughs that are allowed to take and accept property taxes. So there's about, what would that be, 12 others who don't.
So that's both boroughs and municipalities, total of 18 in the state?
Yeah, I could get a definitive number for you on that, but I think that's an estimate. That's a good question. Yeah, and so this map kind of shows from top to bottom the North Slope Borough, Fairbanks North Star Borough. We have Valdez, Anchorage, Kenai Peninsula Borough, and the Bristol Bay Borough. They all take full advantage of the current $50,000 residential property tax exemption. There's been a lot of media coverage recently, including an article that was in the Newsminer last week that described some dramatic increases. You know, it described one homeowner whose property doubled in assessed value, which doesn't mean the property taxes will double, but it could mean a substantial increase. Just to put in perspective, you know, property taxes are one of the larger taxes most Alaskans pay who are homeowners, and we rank second in that nationwide. A few of these cost of living things that I included, just to put it in perspective, you know, gas has increased a lot, even in the last year, 30%. The price of natural gas has tripled, and we've had slow income growth over the same time. That between the year 2000, year 2020, the last 20 years hasn't even doubled. So that's why we're bringing this bill forward. We think, you know, now's the time for some creative property tax relief solutions. Cost of living's going up. This is a pretty simple one-page bill that just changes the number from $50,000 to $75,000 on that residential property tax exemption. We emphasize this is optional, and you know, homeowners can save quite a bit per year and over a life of a mortgage if you know, if their borough or municipality takes advantage of this.
Okay, and look, how about we go through the section analysis just so we get taken care of that? If we don't mind, then we'll open it for questions. So, Nick, can you go ahead and do that for us, please?
So, we didn't prepare a sectional analysis just because it's one page, but I point members to the bill language, and you can look on line 8. It just increases the amount from $50,000 to $75,000.
Okay.
And it also, it has this consumer price index piece at the bottom that's optional. That's what passed 10 years ago in the initiative. that raised it to 50,000 just to have an optional piece that ties it to the consumer price index. But
and it looks like you're changing it. So 10 years ago, it was the CPI as it related to Anchorage, but now you're changing it to all of urban, so that factors in Fairbanks and Juneau, et cetera?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Okay. I also want to I'll open it for questions, but your presentation, the one with the pink states.
Yeah.
No, not the pink states. Wrong map. It was the one of with the map of Alaska, the yellow and green. You have the Mat-Su borough as one of the six, and I'm pretty sure we spoke with our borough is neutral on this. They said they are not taking advantage of the exemption. You have them as one of the six?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, it's hard to see, but the highlighted boroughs are the ones that take advantage. So right next to Mat-Su, you'll see Valdez that's highlighted. And it's kind of hard. I apologize. It's kind of hard to see.
It's the yellow highlighted.
It's the yellow highlighted piece.
Okay. So I thought it was everything in green. Okay. All right. So I just want to clear that up. Okay. Senator Myers has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. I Senator Gray Jackson was first.
I'm sorry.
Senator Myers. I apologize. Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, I want to thank Senator Wilikowski for bringing this forward. I represent Anchorage 2 District I. And I'm a co-sponsor, and this, you know, I mean, there are serious property tax increases in Anchorage. And you mentioned that you are aware of one assessment that doubled. Yeah, and then you also said that it doesn't necessarily mean their property taxes would double, but I'm here to tell you it does mean that their property taxes will double. If their assessed value doubled, their property taxes are going to double, which is another reason why we really need this bill in place. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I did want to go to the one with the pink states. There we go. So on this chart, it's showing Alaska as number two in the country in terms of property tax burden. I got to wonder, though, a little bit. We've got at least two different versions of property tax in this state that I'm aware of. One is what we're talking about here with our standard local property taxes, most a good chunk of which go to schools and things like that. But we also have the petroleum property tax as well, which is a state assessed at both the borough level and at the state level, depending on where you are. And I would be curious to see where we fall in that ranking if we took the petroleum property tax out. Because, I mean, just for example, the state petroleum property tax is 20 mils, and at my house, I think it's 17 mils. Is the borough assessment rate. So I'd be curious to see where we fall in that ranking if we did that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, through the chair, Senator Myers, I would be happy to get that information to you, to the committee.
Okay, thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
Oh, well, not necessarily follow-up, but I have other questions.
Go for it.
All right. So coming from Fairbanks, I'm not sure necessarily about all the ins and outs in the Anchorage area. Does Anchorage have a tax cap?
Through the chair, they do, Senator Meyer.
Thank you. So as a follow-up to that, it seems to me that – so Fairbanks has a tax cap as well, and I know other communities do. It seems to me that in these areas, effectively what we're talking about is not so much property tax relief as tax shifting. We're still going to be trying to raise the same amount of revenue. I don't imagine that Anchorage or Fairbanks or any other place is going to try to lower the amount of money that they're bringing in. There, we'd just be switching the burden from residential owners to commercial owners or to some other group, higher assessed properties versus lower assessed properties. That's an interesting policy call, and I'm just curious to hear your reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, through the chair, Senator Myers, it's kind of why each borough taxes differently. Like the Anchorage tax cap is a dollar amount, and I understand like Fairbanks is a percentage. And so each borough kind of has to figure out what works best for them. You know, going back to, you know, Bristol Bay borough, for example, they have, you know, most of their revenue is property, is sales taxes. And so it's just kind of, you know, each borough has to balance that out. And so I can't answer that specifically, but, you know, with the tax cap, it will do a little bit of redistribution rather than overall decrease, is my understanding.
Is it on that point?
Yeah.
Okay, because I have a comment on that point. But go ahead, Senator Greitens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your question. Because the way it works is just like with the senior property tax relief and the disabled veteran, the tax burden is spread across the bar, if you will. Everybody's taxes are increased based on everybody's exemption. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do.
Yeah, not necessarily only commercial. It is spread throughout the entire tax base.
And you can respond, Senator Myers?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I do understand the point. I'm just thinking about where else that's going. So, for example, in the Fairbanks area, Fairbanks exists. The borough is funded primarily off of property taxes. But then within the North Pole area, North Pole has both a property and a sales tax. So it'd be an interesting it's going to be interesting to see how that falls out in North Pole if we tax residential property less, at least as a dollar figure goes, how that is going to affect. Are they going to then raise the mill rate so that other that's captured, that dollar figure is captured from other properties, or if they're going to try to raise the sales tax rate instead? It's just an interesting way to see what would happen there.
And on that point, of course, I'll just point out it's optional. So, I mean, North Pole might not decide not to do it. And I know in my area, it's very different from Anchorage. It's a higher concentration of homes, very few businesses. And we have some basic retail. So if we were to do this, and I don't think there's interest right now in this, because it would shift the burden on to very few businesses. And right now we are trying to go from being teenagers to adults in our area, and go from being a bedroom community to more, you know, self-sufficient. So we want to welcome businesses. We want to grow that part, so that heads of households aren't on commuting several hours a day. So in our situation, Anchorage has a much bigger, broader commercial business base, and so each one probably wouldn't get hit as much. So that would be a discussion the people of Anchorage would need to have. One of the things with these kind of things that, I know Senator Wilkowski's not here, but at the way the bill is written now, local assembly, local city council could decide to do this. When we do tax exemptions that are going to shift, it's often good to allow it to go before the voters. So I'd like to know if that is something that the senator has considered. And I know my very first bill as a young freshman, I wasn't that young, but but as a freshman in the House, my first was a tax exemption on certain farm structures. And the purpose of that was to try to help with the food security and getting food in, because we were hearing from local farmers that if they were to store and food to put on the shelves later in the season or get more livestock, that their profits would get eaten up by taxes. So when we did that, that bill actually has to go before the voters, and it was Senator Berta Gardner who made that amendment, and I can understand that, because you are then asking other people to help pick up the tab. So my question, and you, if you already know the senator's position on this, you can give it to us, Nick, or that can be something you can get back with us, amending this to allow voter approval. Do you know if the senator would be okay with that?
Madam Chair, I do not, but would be happy to find that out. And may I make a comment on the commercial piece? So it's interesting to think about the tax burden moving forward. So this year, for example, like in the Mat-Su and in Fairbanks North Star Borough, commercial property assessments have been increasing as well. 15% in Fairbanks North Star Borough, 10% in Mat-Su on average. And that will, you know, and residential is going up as well. So it, you know, in terms of the tax burden, more on commercial versus residential, a lot of that I think is going to be absorbed in the increase and be kind of negligible, because more each kind of group is going to be paying more overall. And that was why I talked to a few assessment offices in different parts of the state, and that was kind of their, you know, 'cause I just wanted to learn more about the impact. And I was kind of relieved to hear that, you know, they thought it wouldn't be too large of an impact because of the increase that everybody's seeing anyway.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I obviously care about the entire state, but I represent Anchorage and District I, and I want to see everybody's taxes distributed fair, pay taxes fairly, property owners and commercial also, but notoriously in our community, commercial property has been, the assessed values has not been what they really should be for many, many years. And this year, the assessed values for property, personal property owners has been extremely higher. And I mean, it's in, like you said, it increased 10% in some areas, even more than 10%. So I wanted to make that comment, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. And go ahead, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question along the, well, comment question sort of along those same lines with the assessments. As the presenter mentioned, the assessments in the Fairbanks area have been going up as well. Mine went up 10% this year. I got a couple of friends who went up 25. And the one thing that a couple of people brought to me, which I didn't realize this, is that in state statute, if you want to challenge your assessment, you can. But if you want to challenge it, the burden of proof is on you to prove that it's wrong, which is a pretty big power imbalance between a homeowner and the borough, in my opinion. And I'm curious if one way that we, if the sponsor would be interested, if possibly one way that we address the property tax burden is instead of changing the dollar figures, if we change that power imbalance and make the burden to prove the assessment fall on the borough rather than fall on the homeowner.
Yeah. Oh, Senator Wilikowski, you snuck in. I was so intensely listening to Senator Myers. So please put yourself on the record. And if you'd like to respond to Senator Myers, we have had a good discussion thus far.
And I, Madam Chair, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage, Chamber, I apologize. I had it's rare that I get two hearings, and I had two hearings at the same time.
Good for you.
And that one started before this one. So thank you. And it's a good question. And it, I guess we can do some research on it. This is an interesting issue because, as you know, property taxes are within the realm of local communities, and Senator Gray Jackson probably has much more expertise on this than I do. And so we don't sort of get too much into the details of how they're administered, and but we can certainly look into it, check in with local communities. I just don't know if it's something that the state can regulate or not, to be quite frank with you, as I sit here. I know it seems odd to me that the state can regulate how much property tax exemptions local communities are allowed, but that is the way the state operates. But we can look into that for sure, Senator.
Senator Myers?
Just a follow-up comment to that. It's actually in state statute. What I state, I'd have to go back and double-check to find the statute itself, but it's actually state statute that says that the burden is on the homeowner to prove that the borough was wrong and not the other way around. So, I mean, it is already there that as to how that's regulated.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can follow up. But in Anchorage, we have a system that really, really works because usually the proof is based on surrounding properties, too, and their assessed value. And our property appraisal division, they work with folks that come forward and want to have their value reassessed. And usually they work things out before it even gets to the commission that even addresses it or board that addresses the issue. So we have a really good system for folks who feel that they were overassessed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm guessing that around the state that those people in the various municipalities are going to be super busy here this year. Yes, this year. So in the presentation, you said the average savings would be $400 for a homeowner. I don't know if that was across the state or Anchorage specific. But as Anchorage as an example, do you know what the average increase of property taxes will be for homeowners based on these higher assessments? And then if this were to pass and the Anchorage Assembly were saying, yes, we want to go forward this, what would the average increase be to the higher assessed residential properties and commercial properties?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill Wilikowski, for the record. I can't tell you what the average increase would be with these property tax assessments. It actually, quite frankly, could be nothing. It's up to the Anchorage Assembly to decide to set the mill rate. And again, Senator Gray Jackson has much more depth of experience and knowledge on this than I do. I can't answer that question. The reason we can give you an estimate of $400 is that's based on what the current mill rate is and what the difference in the tax would be under that current mill rate. From 50,000 to 75,000, we estimate it to be around.
That's subject to change, and so that the when we talked about property on average, the assessments are going about 10%. I believe it's 13% in the borough, and we talked about this earlier. But does that mean if it's 13% assessments up 13%, does that mean the increase of 13% property taxes? Does that math come out the same or?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it not necessarily. Again, it's going to be at least in Anchorage and probably every community sets their mill rates. And so it would.
Well, based on the mill rate staying the same.
If the mill rate stayed. Again, I'd probably defer to Senator Gray Jackson.
Okay, let me
give you a really quick and dirty example, okay? So if a person's assessed valuation went up $100,000 and the mill levy was 14.5%, they're going to pay another $1,450 in taxes. That's just a really quick example of how it works.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Are there any other questions? We did have a question, and Nick didn't want to respond on your behalf. I thought you might have had a conversation. The question was, and I'll just go back. My very first bill as a freshman was on farm structures exemption, and Senator Berta Gardner amended it on the Senate floor to allow it to go to the voters. So the assembly of the city council could vote, yes, we want to put this on a ballot, and then the voters would ultimately decide. Is that something you would be open to, since there is some shifting that would occur?
Madam Chair, I have no strong feeling on that one way or another. I like the giving the local communities the ability to have a say in this. If the Anchorage Assembly or Fairbanks North Star Borough or Matsu Borough decides they want to do that, I guess my initial reaction is let the local communities decide what the best way to do it. There are elected officials and decide. But if this body decides that it should be something that should be done by a vote, I don't know what the charter says in Anchorage, whether that's something, again, turn to Senator Gray Jackson, who knows much more in detail about that. But I don't have a strong feeling on it one way or another at this point.
So I'm going to turn to Senator Gray Jackson. Is there anything in the Anchorage's charter where something like this would automatically go to the voter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think so. But I can tell you right now, and if it did go to voters, it would probably pass by 70% or more. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so I had another question. It is, what kind of support opposition are you hearing? Have you heard from any folks yet?
Bill Lukowski, I'll turn to Nick on that one. I have not heard of opposition to it, any formal opposition, but I'll turn to Nick because he's been talking to people and gathering support and opposition.
Madam Chair, I have not heard any formal opposition. I've heard a lot of support, and a lot of realtors are excited that there's attempts to lower property taxes out there. But
what about chambers of commerce? Have they weighed in?
They have not weighed in.
Okay. And AML hasn't weighed in formally yet.
They have not weighed in.
Okay. Senator Myers.
Just a comment to Mr. Moe's statement there that if realtors are excited about it, what that makes me think is that they think that will result in more sales, hence values will continue to go up. So it concerns me a little bit that realtors are very happy about this.
Good point. Is there anything else you'd like? I think we're up against the clock here, but I'll give you a chance if you have some wrap-up comments. So, Lukowski.
Thank you again. I guess just to respond to that, in my experience, I've seen realtors typically oppose property tax increases because they, yes, they do believe it probably would. People are more likely to buy things when they're cheaper. So I think that's as a general statement, that's probably true. I don't know. Would it impact future property tax appraisals? It is possible.
And one point, if I may, yeah. Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
In smaller communities, lowering the homeowner property tax exemption helps encourage folks to stay in those communities too, so they're not being priced out of their homes. And I heard from the person I talked to in Bristol Bay Borough that, you know, prioritizing some existing homeowner property tax relief is something that's one of the reasons why they went to the 50,000. So it helps, you know, population.
So that drives a point to me. Changes in taxes impact behavior. They do. All right. So with that, we're going to set this aside and thank you both, Senator Wilkowski and Mr. Moe, for joining us today. Our next committee meeting will convene at 3:30 p.m. next Tuesday, February 22nd, and we will bring back SB 181, Identification of Contractor and Ads, and consider a committee substitute reminder that a deadline for amendments on that bill, that's on the contractor in ads, SB 181, was set for tomorrow, Friday, February 8th, by close of business. After SB 181 on Tuesday, we'll bring back this bill, SB 172, by Senator Wilkowski for public testimony. Are there any questions or additional remarks from committee members? So seeing no other business to come before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:01 p.m.